Welcome to Supply Circles, stories from the innovators, disruptors, and improvers in supply chain management today, brought to you by AI Group.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to Supply Circles, or welcome if it's your first time. I'm James Scotland, coming to you from Yungaburra Language Region in beautiful Surfers Paradise. It's a lovely day today, and I'm excited to be sitting here chatting with you. We've got a great guest. You're going to be fascinated by what she has to tell us, and I'm looking forward to the next hour. It's a different platform today, different program. We're going to do it a little bit differently. When you hear this, we'll be a couple of days from Anzac Day, the day that we all stop and commemorate the many, many Australians who have provided service to this country in our defence, who have, in particular, lost their life or been injured, and the families that are affected by that. It's a great day of reflection, and I pay my respects to all the people who have defended our country in some way. There's a timely to mention that, because what we're going to talk about today is an issue that is about to start affecting most people who have been involved in the Defence Force in lots of different shapes, not just active defence people, but also in the Department of Defence and other areas. It's affecting your company in the future, and it will affect your supply chain up and down. So it's a timely issue to discuss. It's called SAMS, and I'll explain that shortly. To hear all about it, my guest is an emerging voice and leader in commercial law in Australia. We love having emerging leaders on Supply Circles, so I'm pleased to say that Rhiannon Willis is joining us. She's got a good reputation and good CV after only a short time. She is a commercial lawyer, meaning that she is, like all of us listening, a strong commercial. She has, like all of us listening, a strong commercial bent. We'll give her a tick for that. She's not only a law graduate from Monash, she also has a degree in my favourite topic, international business. Oh, big tick for that, Rhiannon. And she has worked in procurement in both Australia and in London. Double ticks for that. And as I said, best of all, she's an emerging leader in her field. It's good to have her on the show. In just a few short years, Rhiannon has plied her trade in, as I said, Melbourne and in London. She has built broad-based skills and experience, and she's a fine person, wonderful human being. Among other competencies, she has gained a good reputation for creating client contracts in areas such as sales terms, data protection, and shareholder agreements. She has advised clients in contract negotiations with the government, particularly the Commonwealth, and she has advised clients on compliance issues with Australia's export control laws. She has helped clients with compliance with the Australian consumer law and in responding to the ACCC investigations. And she's a handy hand at reviewing internal supplier agreements and assessing for legal and business risk. And on top of all that, she's a member of the Supreme Court of Australia. And all that's been done in only about 10 years in the workforce. Like I said, she's one of us. I'm really excited because she has made herself an expert in understanding this new regulation that I want to talk about, SAMS. I'm keen to hear about that, but I'm also keen to hear how she built such a good CV in such a short time. So let's get into it. Hello, Rhiannon. Welcome to the show. Is that the best intro you've ever had?
Yeah, hi, James. It definitely is. I'm impressed.
Yeah, whenever someone introduces me when I'm on stage, I always get up and say, it's like a dad joke, I always get up and say, wow, that's really good. I can't wait to hear me speak.
Yeah. I can't wait to meet me, right?
Exactly. Let's start at the beginning. You studied at the prestigious Monash University. Are you from Melbourne?
I'm not, actually. I'm a transplant. My parents are Kiwis. I was born in Papua New Guinea, lived all over the world. Well, the Pacific side of the world anyway, before we moved to Australia. Moved to Tasmania, though, when we came to Australia. So I'm from Tassie, was raised in Tassie from about 8 or so, and then moved to Melbourne for uni.
Your parents were obviously island-type people.
They definitely were.
New Zealand, PNG, Tasmania,
yep.
Australia.
We lived in Fiji too, yeah. They love the islands.
That sounds like a wonderful upbringing, a wonderful place to grow up.
Fiji was fantastic, absolutely. Great place to be a kid. You're constantly outside, constantly swimming and running around. and great weather. Can't go wrong.
And you don't have to wear shoes.
That too, exactly.
So you went to Monash. Were you always keen on law as a profession, or did you end up there?
Yeah, I was keen on law from a young age. I mean, my childhood dream was to be a pilot, but I don't have the world's best eyesight, so that was always just going to be a dream. And then, I don't know, from sort of my early teens, I think I liked the sound of law. Had a friend with a mum who was a lawyer, and I talked to her a few times, and yeah, it just seemed to suit me.
It sounds like a joke, but it's not really. I said to some friends of mine when I was in Darwin, I said, I think I might take up parachuting as a hobby. I'd like to jump out of a plane. And they said, you're a strategist, James. You have no attention to detail. It's the one thing you need if you're going to be a parachutist.
Yeah.
It's also an important issue for pilots. But most of all, it's an important issue for lawyers. You need that attention to detail, don't you? It's a detailed profession.
It very much is, yes. And we've got obligations to our clients as well to make sure we do a good job for them. So attention to detail is a big part of that.
Did you think the uni prepared you for the workplace, or was it a leap?
It's interesting. I think if you'd asked me even just a few years ago, I would have said, it's a very theory focused, I guess, when you study law, and you learn a lot, and it's stuff you need to know, right, to be a lawyer. But I wouldn't say it necessarily prepares you for the workplace. But in the more recent years, as I've kind of expanded my social circle outside of other lawyers and gotten to know people, it's interesting. I think there are things that they teach you at university when you're studying law, and I'm sure in other professions, that you don't realize you're learning. And it's sort of a way of thinking and thinking about both sides of an issue that I realize is not quite as common as I assumed it was. And I think that prepares you well for the workplace and life in general, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because a commercial lawyer, a person who combines commercial thinking and legal thinking, is in some ways kind of at odds with each other. There has been many times when a legal mind says, be a bit cautious here, whereas an entrepreneurial mind says, no, don't be cautious, mm-hmm. go hard. Having the ability to understand the thinking behind both, I think is probably something that is really to your advantage.
Absolutely. It's about kind of putting risk into practice, I guess, and assessing it. So yes, there's a legal position, and generally a legal position is fairly conservative, but businesses can't always be conservative. That's not really the way to succeed. So it's understanding both of those sides, assessing the risk, and deciding to go ahead with whatever your decision is.
Yeah. So tell me about the career. You ended up at BAE, which is a multinational defence contractor.
I did, yeah. So I finished uni, and a few of my friends were kind of all a year ahead of me, and they'd started their legal careers, and we'd go out for dinner and I'd still be studying, and they'd talk about their jobs and talk about work, and it all sounded very miserable. So I decided I didn't want to go into law after all, and decided to try something else. So I accepted a procurement job with BAE, and that's kind of how I fell into procurement. It was, I guess, not planned, but I applied for a bunch of different things, and this job sounded the most interesting, and they were interested in me, obviously, because they offered it to me, and that's where I ended up.
One of the challenges for supply chain management is that there is not a lot of training in supply management. They're starting to be a bit more now, but we attract a lot of people who are these detailed people. A lot of legal minds come into supply chain, and a lot of engineers come into supply chain because, we build systems and make it work well. And procurement, of course, is a legal contract.
Mm-hmm.
You worked in London. How did you end up there?
Well, I actually went to Germany first. I lived in Germany for a year, just kind of bummed around, not working too hard. Enjoyed living in Europe and wasn't ready to come home, so I moved to London. Got back to an actual career when I was in London and went straight into procurement. But I worked in a finance company, a fintech at the time. So it was a little bit different from defence, where I'd started, that's for sure. And it was the tech side of it. So that was quite interesting. And then I moved on from there, stayed in tech procurement, until I eventually came back around to law. I decided I did want to give that a go after all, and ended up at Amazon in their legal team. But it was still a lot of it on the tech side. It was Amazon Web Services, so that's dealing with the cloud and, you know, contracts related to that and to their customers. But it was quite interesting, you know, moving back into an actual legal role after studying it, but then working in procurement for so long. And it was a role that helped me, you know, use my legal knowledge and background, but also where I could rely on my experience, I guess, working with suppliers and on the procurement side and managing suppliers. It was a kind of a hybrid role with Amazon, which was quite a good find at that time.
What did you learn about procurement and supply chains?
Well, it's an interesting kind of role. On the procurement side, I'd done both the buying, which is at BAE, strict buying, and then I'd done supply management and more of the contracting side of it a few years later once I moved to Europe. So on the buying side, it was very transactional, but very, very detail oriented with the types of stuff we were buying. And then on the contract management side was, I think, where my strengths really, really lay. Obviously, with my legal background, that was something that I could really, I could add a lot of value, I think, for the companies I was working with. I could review these contracts that wouldn't be going to a different legal team, because that was not a common thing. So I would be able to review them and make sure that they presented lower risk for us. And, you know, obviously was something that our suppliers were happy to sign up to as well.
Yeah, it's one of the things we say often on this show is that the relationship between supplier and buyer is important. It's a critical relationship. It's how you make money by selling and buying stuff. But it's based on people. You know, there's Rhiannon over here looking at the contracts. There's you over here trying to sell the contract. And it's people. It's not some sort of, you know, big corporations, people working with people, but also the details are important. You know, what structure the agreement right, work out what you both can live with.
Absolutely. I remember doing one contract a little while back when I was working in London, and my stakeholder internally, he was a wonderful person to work with. I liked him a lot, but he didn't have the best commercial mind. So he'd go into a call or into a meeting, because this was actually pre-COVID, so it was of course all in person. He'd go into a meeting with the suppliers and just kind of tell them everything, you know, everything, what we wanted, what we were willing to accept, and just like word vomit it all out there. And I'd be like, hang on. Let's stop right there. Let's start with, you know, start with what we want. And then if we need to, we can get to what we'll accept. But yeah, so he wasn't great on the negotiation side, but obviously being that kind of person, he was very good on the people side. So he had very good relationships with the suppliers, and he did manage them, you know, obviously a lot more closely than my involvement. So he had strengths and weaknesses, like we all do.
And was it the first time that you were the scary legal type saying, stop doing that?
I think so, because I did have to say to him, don't go in there and say everything like you like to do. And trying to put that feedback in a way that, you know, maintained our relationship, because I really did like and respect him. He was a wonderful colleague. But this was just something that he wasn't great at, and he did need the feedback on.
How did you handle it? Just straight out honesty, like, man, what are you doing?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, honestly, that is what I did. I just went up and I said, look, I know that you get a little bit nervous and you sort of talk a lot. It's good in these kind of things to just say your piece once and then let them speak. Just be quiet.
Let's talk about word vomits.
Exactly.
What was London like? Is it remarkably different from working in Melbourne or Australia?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, jobs are jobs everywhere, right? So there are a lot of similarities. But London, it's a huge city, very multicultural. A lot of the companies you're dealing with are global companies, and a lot of them are headquartered in London. So you're kind of dealing more on a macro scale, I guess. You know, things get a little bit smaller out here in Australia, not all things, but some things. And it's all a lot more fast paced, a lot bigger deals working out of London. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, just in your experience, imagine working for AWS, Amazon Web Services here compared to London. The issues would be wildly different.
They would be, but AWS is a very interesting kind of place because their legal team is very segregated, right? So you've got one part of the legal team does this one function, and I know the Australian legal team will deal with Australia and Asia, so they'll actually have quite a lot of big deals as well over here. But yeah, when you're in London, a lot of it is bigger than what you're going to get in Australia. It'll obviously compare to I imagine working in New York. Not that I've done that one.
No, but maybe one day. What do you do now?
Well, now,
commercial lawyer.
Yeah, now I'm a commercial lawyer for AI Group. So what do? It's a lot of...
I forgot to mention that. You're my colleague.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. I forgot to mention that not only is Rhiannon a beautiful human being, she's also my colleague.
Lucky me. So, yeah, we do a lot of contract review, a lot of negotiation. We'll advise clients on legal positions generally in relation to, I guess, trade and commerce. Generally, we've got clients from all sorts of industries. So you've got defense, you've got health and aged care, intellectual property, retail, hospitality. You know, it's a very varied job, and every day is different, which is something you hear a lot. And I hadn't really experienced it before coming here, but it's really, really interesting because no day is the same. Any kind of random piece of work.
Is it mainly helping businesses be good suppliers? Like, is it mainly kind of working up the, or in actual fact, down the supply chain?
Yeah, it goes both ways. So being, I guess, good customers, because they'll also have their own suppliers, and making sure they've got, you know, the protection and the risk protection they need when you look up the supply chain, and then also towards their customers and their consumers, and making sure that they're complying with the various laws we've got in Australia that protect consumers. That is a big part of what we do.
We were talking a while ago on this show about how once upon a time, years and years ago, your suppliers came from within the sort of area in which you did business. You just sort of walked down the road or drove down the road and bought stuff from someone down the road. And then as we started building international businesses, we started buying from people all around the world. And because we were buying from people and businesses all around the world, there eventually became this concern that we weren't doing it as best we could, which created ESG, environmental and social governance. Boards started saying, are you sure you're doing the right contracts? Are you sure you're dealing with the people you should be dealing with? Are you looking after the environment? Mm-hmm. Do you do much work in ESG?
It's not really one of my areas of expertise, but I do know a little bit about it. It's been announced by the ACCC as a number one focus for them in this 24-25 year.
What does that mean?
So that's in relation to misleading and deceptive conduct at the moment. So what mm-hmm. they're focusing on are businesses making claims about their ethical or environmental, I can't think of the word.
Greenwashing is what you're talking
Greenwashing
about.
Greenwashing is what I'm talking
when
about.
When you say one thing and do the opposite, is that the what they're focusing on? Are you backing up your claims of being an environmentally sound business?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So if they're making false claims, the ACCC is going after them, making sure that what they're claiming they are actually doing and can do. You've got, you know, businesses that will claim things that current technology, they can't actually meet those claims. And they're saying, you know, in 50 years, this is where we're going to be. But that's a projection that is based on hope, not any kind of science or fact.
Yeah.
And so the ACCC is really cutting down on that. There have been a few cases lately where they've really focused on this. I think they won. I think it was ASIC actually that won the case recently against Vanguard. Mercer Superannuation settled a case last year about greenwashing. So it really is a focus, and it's important that businesses don't overstate their approach to ESG and their goals with it.
Yeah, this is a serious business and there's legal implications. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it's happened here, but I know that in these states they had companies that were saying that we're doing carbon offsets because we're buying acres and acres and acres in the Amazon forest. And when it got checked out, they say, no, you're not. I mean, you bought that a few years ago, but then after you bought it, the forest was sold to to a business to make paper or something. So it looks right, but it's actually not. So they're doing a lot more work. But I think we're not in that kind of, deliberate screwing around.
No, and we've always had laws against misleading and deceptive conduct. Well, I mean, not always, but they're well established in Australian law. So it's more that the ACCC is bringing it in as a focus so that companies are on notice that if you're making false claims in relation to ESG, you're going to be targeted and you shouldn't do it. It's unfair and misleading to your consumers when that is something that is of high interest to a lot of consumers at the moment.
Yeah, even more so as consumers start saying we want to deal with companies that are environmentally responsible.
Yeah.
You really have to make sure you're right. The other area that's foremost on most business people's mind at the moment, Rhiannon, is cybersecurity. And there's a lot of work being put into making sure that our businesses are protected in cyber. A lot of good processes being put in place, a lot of good thinking. One of the things that perhaps is not always understood is that there's actually a fiduciary requirement as well. There's a legal requirement to making sure that you have strong cybersecurity practices in place. Can you talk to that for a minute?
Yeah, sure. There absolutely is. So you've got general director's duties, and that's a responsibility for anyone who's a director of a business in Australia, and that will cover cybersecurity. So you've got duties like the duty to act in good faith, to act with care and diligence, and that just requires that your work as a director, you're exercising, I guess, your power in that role with the care and diligence that reasonable person would be expected to in that role. And so that's where it comes into cybersecurity. So there's not necessarily a director's duty about cybersecurity, but you do need to make sure that you're protecting your employees and your customers, and that will include cybersecurity.
Yeah, we've said that cybersecurity is the same as physical security. You know, back in the 90s, we put in places things to make sure that you had a safe workplace, a healthy workplace, and that your employees went home at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. This one is the same, except it's a cybersecurity. Take it as seriously as you do OH&S or WSE.
Absolutely. And we've got, privacy laws in Australia, and they're currently being updated at the moment, which is about protecting employee and consumer data, and taking all the reasonable steps to protect that data. So it's things like only keeping it for as long as you need it, or as long as required by law, and then destroying it. If you don't need to keep the data of your customers for 20 years, don't. It's just putting yourselves and your customers at risk. And you've got to have, processes in place so that you do deal with data in that way.
And we're seeing more and more comments that our IT guru says, if people don't need to know your personal details, don't give it to them.
Yeah.
It's just phishing. They're just saying, what's your name and a birth date? Because it's good to have it on records for our marketing purposes. Mm-hmm. But our guys are saying, stop doing that. Just don't give it to them, or give them a fake one.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another, I guess, key one in privacy law. Don't collect data of your customers that you don't need. Birthdays are a big one. just about every retailer, if you sign up to a mailing list for them, they'll ask for your birthday so they can send you a happy birthday newsletter, maybe sometimes a discount on your birthday. Do they need to do that? Well,
yeah. Well, I ran sales and marketing for an insurance and finance company for 7 years, and birth date is the identifier. There might be 8 or 9 Rhiannon Willises who live in your suburb in Melbourne, but only one has got your birth date. There's only one. The chances of there being 2 people with the same name on the same birth date is just so small. It's not. So birthdays are identifiers. It's one of your key identifiers. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to give your birthday out. Don't.
Yeah, keep it to yourself. Absolutely.
Yeah. We should take a break and then come back and talk about SAMs. It's good to hear your insights on these things. Your name's Rhiannon. I often ask people where they got their name from. Our boss, CEO, our CEO, Innes Willocks, said that Innes is the Scottish word for James. So,
There you go.
Him and I, there you go.
Yeah.
Rhiannon, I'm going to make a wild stab and suggest that your parents, whilst they were wandering around the islands, were also big Fleetwood Mac fans. You seem to be in that age group.
Absolutely. Yes, they were.
Oh, true.
although it took a long time for my dad to admit that I was named after the song. Always it was, no, no, we just liked the name. And then one day he had, I guess, a wine too many and he confessed to naming me after the song.
Well, it's a good song. You know, I guess you know the song.
Of course, of course. It is a good song. It was interesting when I was living in the UK. You know, it's a Welsh name, so it's a lot more common over there.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, it's from Wales, and we've got no Welsh heritage in my family. It's just Fleetwood Mac fans.
Fleetwood Mac heritage.
But it was funny. A lot of people had I guess expectations on how my name is pronounced, and they very strongly emphasise the O apparently. And when I introduced myself, someone was like, "Are you sure that's not how you pronounce it?" Because I don't overemphasise the O. They're very Rhiannon. And I just sort of, yeah, just throw it out there. And I was just like, look, I'm not Welsh. I'm not overly attached to the Welsh pronunciation. Just call me something that sounds vaguely familiar and I'll probably answer to it.
Is it a nice pronunciation? Do they say it nicely?
I don't know. I'm used to saying it my way. So it sounded a little bit jerky to me, like overemphasizing the O. So, yeah, I don't know.
My good friend Michael, who listens to the show, and Michael called his daughter Niamh because he has an Irish heritage, mm-hmm. and Niamh is spelled N-I-A-M-H. So he said, I said, that's a nice name, Michael, I guess. And he said, yes, I just subjected my daughter to a lifetime of spelling her name.
Yes. Yeah. My niece's middle name is Niamh as well, but luckily you don't have to spell your middle name that often.
Not that often. All right, let's go to a break. It's a great chat, and we'll come back and talk about Sam's.
If you have supply chain or business improvement challenges, contact AI Group's Business Improvement and Growth Hub. The Big Hub is a library of practical and relevant resources designed to assist member businesses to grow and improve. The Big Hub also includes an extensive network of experienced, pre-qualified business improvement consultants. For more details, contact big@aigroup.com.au. That's big@aigroup.com.au.
Rhiannon, a big issue, or an emerging issue, I should say, an emerging issue in Australia is a thing called SAMS, the Safeguarding of Australian Military Secrets. With all the stuff going on in geopolitics and geomilitary and all the troubles around the world, the idea of safeguarding Australia's military secrets is a good idea. Recently, the government's come up with a solution for it, though, and it's not necessarily the full answer just yet. I want to talk about that. Could you explain SAMS to everyone listening?
Yeah, sure. So at a high level, it's, as you mentioned, for safeguarding Australia's military secrets, but it introduces a couple of fences that prohibit work for foreign governments or government bodies. Sounds okay, like you said, at a high level. But when you look at the legislation, it's very broadly drafted. So you've got some, like I mentioned, these two offences, one that hits all defence employees, ex-defence employees, sorry, and one that applies to actually all Australians.
Okay. How did you get involved in this? Let's just put it in context. How did you end up? Don't tell me someone from AI Group walked down the corridor and said, hey, find out all about SAMS, Rhiannon.
So, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Our head of Defence Council came to me. She had been invited to appear at the parliamentary inquiry into the SAMS Act. AI Group had submitted a response to the draft legislation late last year, and she needed a briefing on the legislation. And obviously, she'd been involved in preparing this draft response, but it had been a little while. And she needed to understand what the risks were with the legislation. And so that's when I came into it. I hadn't heard of SAMS at that point, but I quickly did.
I only heard about SAMS a little while ago. You've got months of advance on this from everybody. My understanding is that the idea was if I am ex-military and I'm going to go overseas somewhere or talk to an overseas company about my area of expertise, I have to get approval to do that because it might be revealing military secrets. Is that sort of basically it?
Basically, there are two offences. The one that you're talking about is the first one where an ex-defence employee, and that covers, as you mentioned, I think in your intro, that covers veterans as well as public service employees from the Department of Defence and a number of other categories of ex-defence employees. And it prevents them from performing work for a foreign government or government body without authorisation. And that's where it gets very broad, because a government body can include a wide variety of organisations that you might not expect to be included in that. So public universities are an example, and you can't do any work for them. It doesn't need to be work that's connected to your defence career. It's any work. You can't be a janitor.
That's the key bit. It's any work without approval.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the second offence?
So the second offence applies to all Australians, Australian citizens and permanent residents. And that's an offence where if you provide training in relation to an export controlled good or military tactics, techniques or procedures to a foreign government, that's when you're committing the offence and you need the authorisation before providing that training.
That kind of makes sense. But the first one, isn't the first one covered by the Official Secrets Act? As a defence person, I signed Department of Defence employee, I signed declarations. Isn't that covered already?
So in some ways, we've got in the criminal code, we've got offences for, you know, covert actions on behalf of a foreign country that endangers Australia's national security, and sharing information with a foreign country that endangers our national security. Mm-hmm. You also, of course, got offences in dealing with information that's subject to a security clearance. The difference with this is that it gets you before you endanger national security effectively. So it's the offence is working without authorisation. The offence is not releasing sensitive information. And that's the key difference to those existing offences.
I've worked with defence and defence supply companies for many years, 30 years, I guess, and I have worked closely with many senior officers of defence. And they come with great skills, and any company would be really happy to have these people in their employ.
Absolutely.
To all of my mates, you know that I think you need to be trained in talking non-defence and talking like normal people. But apart from that, they have wonderful training and wonderful skills. This sounds like it might end up being a hassle to hire people ex-defence.
It absolutely will be. And being ex-defence is not obviously a protected category under any anti-discrimination laws. So the likely impact is that unless your skills are so key and so needed for the particular role, industry is going to prioritise someone who doesn't need that authorisation. And our ex-defence employees, a lot of them do stay in the defence industry. They'll work for any of our defence contractors in Australia. But a lot of our defence contractors in Australia have some form of foreign government ownership. I don't want to name names, but there is a lot of that in
Australia. Well, just think most of them. That would be the answer.
That is absolutely when you're talking about the major ones.
A general one would be Boeing. I'm not picking in on the guys from Boeing. Hello, Boeing. But everyone knows Boeing is not an Australian company. Everyone knows Boeing is not an Australian company. But they do work in defence. That might affect me as an ex-military person doing just contracting to them.
Mm-hmm. It definitely will, and it's not even just working for that company in Australia, but a lot of the work they do is with various other countries, and it's not necessarily work that will prejudice Australia's national security interests, but it's work that does involve, you know, some kind of connection with pick a government foreign body, and that is where you're prohibited. So if you're in a role with one of these defence contractors that has a global focus, you probably can't do that as an ex-defence employee unless you have authorisation. And there's not a lot of detail about the authorisation process. So,
well, that was going to be the next question. Is it just simply just submit a form and it comes automatically bouncing back saying approved? We just don't know.
We don't know yet. The legislation has been enacted. It's currently active. It received royal assent a couple of weeks ago, or maybe just over a week ago. But we don't know what the authorisation process will look like, but it will likely take some time. We obviously know what the permit process is for export permits, and that's a very timely process. The process for applying for security clearance also takes a lot of time. And we expect that this is the kind of process where an individual will need to assess the work you're doing to determine whether you get approval. And once you've got individuals involved in making the assessment, that slows things down, of course.
People listening to this podcast saying, I'm not involved in defence industry in any way, shape or form, and I don't think I have any ex-military people working for me. Will it impact them?
Well, it absolutely does. You've got the second arm, for one thing, which we should talk about briefly. But even with the first arm of it, you might not have ex-defence working for you now, but you may in the future. And it's not necessarily something you always ask people to identify. So you need to think about how you find out whether you've got ex-defence staff applying for jobs that you're considering for a particular role, and whether that role will have any kind of global focus.
As a ex-defence person, maybe I just leave off 20 years from my CV. It's not quite as simple as that. I'm being facetious. But you know, at a time when it's hard to get trained, skilled staff, it's crazy to be leaving out the people from the Defence Force. Physically speaking, this is different from what we're talking about. But you know, I worked in the transport industry, and the best drivers by a country mile were from Defence because they trained them so damn well. Mm-hmm. So you know, you don't want to be avoiding those people that have this great training provided by the Australian government, basically. Tell us about the second, what did you call it? Second arm.
Tell
us about the second arm.
So the second arm is the second offence, which applies to all Australian citizens or permanent residents from providing that specific type of training. And on the surface, it does sound, you know, perfectly reasonable. You want to prevent people from providing that training. But the two types of training you can't provide is in relation to DSGL Part 1 goods, which is a few acronyms there. If you don't know what that means, that's effectively export-controlled goods. So the Part 1 goods are ones that have a military end use. And then the second arm is from providing training in relation to military tactics, techniques or procedures. So with the first arm, the concern that I still have with that, which it's not an unreasonable offence, DSGL goods are prohibited from export without a permit already, and so it makes sense that you're going to limit training on those goods as well. The issue is that the penalties under SAMS are significantly higher than they are under the export control rules. So if you were to export that good without authorization, you'd be subject to 20 years in jail. If you provide training on that good, you double that. You could be subject to 20 years in jail. So it seems a disproportionate penalty given the penalties in relation to actually exporting the good. In terms of the second part of that, military tactics, techniques or procedures, there's no requirement that those military tactics, techniques or procedures are related to Australia at all or the Australian military. So as a very far-fetched example, a university professor who's an Australian citizen has, as some university professors perhaps do, a fairly niche interest in the military tactics of the Vietnamese from the Vietnamese War. That's going back, I don't know, to the 50s and 60s, the Vietnam War. If they are then, you know, hired by a public university in Singapore, for example, they may need authorization to perform that work if they're providing some kind of training on these Vietnamese military tactics. And it's purely an academic focus, right? But that's where it's...
So an Australian academic going to Singapore to speak at a conference on the tactics used by the Viet Cong could potentially break this...
Yeah,
this
technically
regulation.
They'll fall under this offence if they don't have authorisation. Now, they're obviously not a focus of the government. Right. They're not the target of this legislation. But whether or not they're a target, they're still breaching the offence if they don't have authorisation. And when you're talking about 20 years in jail, I'm not sure I'd be willing to risk it.
Yeah. Wow. What do you think will happen? How's it going to unfold from here? Is it settled or is there still plenty of wiggle room to get things sorted out?
Well, as I said earlier, it has been enacted. It has passed royal assent. So the new legislation is in place. Where we're focusing at the moment is on ministerial exemptions from the authorization process. There are some exceptions already in the legislation. They're pretty basic ones, things like if you're performing work for, you know, humanitarian aid or for the Red Cross, for example, or if you're performing work, you know, under a contract for the Commonwealth, then you're exempted from this. So those are kind of obvious ones. A couple of the other exemptions that they're thinking about are in relation to how long you've since you've left defence when we talk about that first arm. So I think they're considering a 10-year kind of application. So if you left defence more than 10 years ago, you'll theoretically be exempt from this.
So there's a thought that if you've left defence 10 years ago, you don't know what the hell you're talking about?
Yes,
I'll use that in conversations with my friends.
Or perhaps to your friend's benefit, then maybe not, but perhaps their information is out of date.
You don't need to stand up for them there.
They can stand up for themselves. Good. And then the other exemption that we're expecting is in relation to certain job roles for the ex-defence staff. So when they performed certain job roles, then they might not be subject to this offence. But we don't know what those job roles look like yet. These are just theoretical exceptions that have been mentioned by the government as things they're considering.
A good friend of mine was a journalist in the army, and he left and you know joined the journalistic profession more than 10 years ago. But you know, you tend to think, well, journalism may not have anything at all to do with military secrets, except they may have been in country, in which case it might also pick it up. Is that kind of, you know, really confused area?
Exactly, and this is where it's hard to figure out the types of job roles that might be exempt, because if you think about something like a cook. You know, a cook you might expect doesn't have access to any secretive Australian military secrets, so they might be exempt from this. But then if they're a cook on a submarine, they might actually have some military secret knowledge that you just pick up by virtue of being on a submarine.
Which is more than I've done and probably you've done.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to know to what level they'll focus on those job role exemptions, except that we know they're considering them. And then, the other exemption is certain foreign countries. So they'll pick a few that we don't consider concerning and exempt those roles.
Yeah, sure. There's a few. We've got some friends.
We do, yeah. Not too many, but some.
All right, legal. What should I do as a business owner? What's my next step? And also, so the first question is, as a business owner, what should I do? And second step, as a ex-military person, what should I do?
So as a business owner, well, you know what, I'm actually going to take those around the other way. The ex-military person, the offence applies to the individual and the obligations are on the individual. So the ex-military, ex-defence employee should consider whether they need authorization under this legislation. Are they performing any roles for or on behalf of a foreign government body? And that's where you need to think about who your end customer really is. It's not, you know, if you're employed by an Australian company, you're out of it. Who are you doing the work for in the long run? So that's where you need to.
So does that mean they have to find out who owns the company? And isn't that complicated?
Exactly. That's one of the other major concerns with this legislation. It's very difficult to find that information out, and especially certain countries do have a lot of foreign ownership and they hide it. So the average individual is going to struggle to find that out. I just did a quick search earlier to find some state universities to see, you know, to throw them out as an example, what kind of state-owned universities might exist in various foreign countries. And even that is hard to find out. You know, you've got a lot of public universities, whether the government has control over them, it's harder to determine. So you can assume that the average...
So the individuals have to figure this out themselves and then make an application. So they just better find out about this regulation, basically. If you are ex-defence or ex-Department of Defence, get up to speed with this new SAMS.
Absolutely. And then in terms of what the business should do, yeah, a good business wants to protect their employees. So we would recommend that businesses assess what ex-defence employees they've got or what work they do for well, and what work they do for foreign governments or government bodies, and also, you know, determine whether they're providing any training on these military tactics, techniques, or procedures, or export controlled goods, and so that they can determine who might fall under this legislation and help educate their employees where that's the case.
Okay, and we'll put some links in the show notes about some places to go and have a look to find out a bit more. I'm sure you have found some links over your research.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information out yet about SAMs, which is concerning because of how much of an impact it has, and the fact that it's already been enacted. But we can point you to certain pages that we'll set up and detail some of the obligations of the individuals.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, let's do that. What did you learn about the creation of laws and regulations from this exercise? Just to finish up, your last question is, what have you learned?
Well, it's been an interesting process. It's interesting to see how legislation is drafted, and it really kind of hits home that it is drafted by people, and people aren't perfect. We all make mistakes. We can't account for every loophole or every scenario that is going to be impacted by a piece of legislation. Unfortunately, in this case, I think they've gone too far in that they haven't accounted for many scenarios that will be hit by this legislation. And I think that's really an important thing that the government should have focused on.
Well, and do you think you could have influenced it more if you'd been more heavily involved? Or is it just something that, as a lawyer, you just watch it happen and try and interpret?
No, it's not something that I think we could have influenced any more. We certainly had we worked hard to influence it in the ways we could already. We submitted proposals. We spoke in the parliamentary inquiry. So we've done as much influence as we possibly could. Unfortunately, I think we haven't been as successful as we would have liked. And so we're focusing now on trying to influence some of those ministerial exemptions and to broaden them a little bit.
All right. Well, I won't blame you for this.
Please don't.
Strange thing. One of the things that our colleague Tennant Reid always says is that the one thing that every government of all generations are very good at is passing the laws of unintended consequences. It sounds like this is another example of
this
that.
This is definitely one of them, and it's really going to hit our ex-defence staff and veterans in particular, which is unfortunate given they've given so much to the country already.
Yeah, and at a time when we are short of good stuff, it's bad news for business as well. Uh-huh. What's next for you? Are you going to keep your head down when people come walking down the corridor and say, have a look at this, Rhiannon?
Not at all. I've quite enjoyed getting diving deep, I guess, on this legislation. And I'll help work on our submissions for the ministerial exemptions and try and get some in place that will limit the applicability of this act.
Well, good on you. And I've quite enjoyed this conversation. It's been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And thank you for sharing so much knowledge with us. Well, that's it for another episode of Supply Circles. Thanks again to everyone for listening, and thanks for your feedback. We got some great feedback on the AI episode from last time, and it's just really good to hear your thoughts and get your insights and to get your feedback. So thank you for that. If you have any feedback on today's interview with Rhiannon, or ideas for the show, or just want to give me some feedback, hit me up at james.scotland@aigroup.com.au or head over to my LinkedIn page. I'd love to hear from you. And we'll be back in a fortnight with more business improvement insights into the keys to building sustainable supply chains. Thank you for joining me. This is Supply Circles. I'm James Scotland. Bye for now.